Okay, welcome everybody to the last session of the day. This is a panel discussion on ecological compensations. And the purpose of the whole day, of this stakeholder day in this lecture theater, in general, has been to explore the pros and cons of biodiversity offsetting. And to my understanding, the discussion has been pretty good, and it feels like there is some consensus that biodiversity offsetting may work, but that there may also be considerable challenges in their implementation. In this panel that is ending the day, the main focus is in discussing the challenges of implementation, and in particular, perhaps trying to find solutions that might help in proper implementation of biodiversity offsets if we are going that way. Today, Minister Kimmo Tiilikainen opened the day with some remarks on ecological compensation from the perspective of environmental administration, and I think that there were some hints towards the need for some more regulation in his presentation. He stated that some legal analyses in Finland have already indicated that while there are no legal obstacles to undertake voluntary offsets, it is unlikely that they will become more common without some regulatory changes. So this is background for the panel discussion. And now I would like to invite all the panelists to take a seat. And if it does do so, that you just come up here, please. And you can leave me a place in the sofa so I can sit down in a minute as well. So we will start this discussion by watching a video presentation of Sirpa Pietikäinen, who could not make it, but he was able to provide it with some thoughts in video. And after the video, we will start by all of the panelists giving some reflections on what Sirpa is going to say. But before we start, I will shortly introduce all of our panelists. So the video presentation by Sirpa Pietikäinen. So she's a member of the European Parliament, and she's there a member of the Economic and Monetary Affairs Committee and substitute member of the Environment, Public Health and Food Safety Committee, as well as the Women's Rights and Gender Equality Committee. Sirpa's political career is extensive. She has served in the Finnish Parliament for 20 years, and the last 10 years she has been in the European Parliament. She's a graduate from the Helsinki School of Economics and holds a degree in business. Then, here on the podium, we have Satu Hassi. Satu is a member of the Finnish Parliament and the chairperson of the Environment Committee. She has been Minister for the Environment and Development, as well as the chairperson of the Green Party in Finland. Satu has been a member of the European Parliament for 10 years, and in the European Parliament, she was elected as the Vice Chair of the Committee of the Environment, Public Health and Food Safety. She holds a degree in Electrical Power Engineering from Tampere University of Technology, which is great. Then we have Suvi Borgström. Suvi is a senior officer in the Ministry of the Environment, and she is the national focal point for the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform for Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, that is IPES. Suvi holds a PhD in environmental law from the University of Eastern Finland, and she has been a visiting scholar in University of Berkeley. Suvi has written scientific articles, for example, on the compatibility of Habitats Directive with the novel EU Green Infrastructure Policy. Then we have Juha Niemelä. Juha is the Director General of the Natural Resources Department in the Ministry of Agriculture and Forestry. The main task of his department is what he is running is to advance the sustainable use of natural resources, and it is also responsible for developing legislation related to use of natural resources. Before moving to the ministry, he was the Director General of the Center for Economic Development, Transport and the Environment in Central Finland. Juha holds a doctoral degree in agriculture and forestry, and he has been appointed as an adjunct professor to University of Helsinki. So basically, these people are politicians and administrators, but then we also have three scientists on the podium, because the purpose is to try to talk with these two, three groups of people at the same time. So we have here Joe Bull. And Joe is a lecturer in conservation science at University of Kent, and his research fields cover landscape ecology and socio-ecological systems dynamics, particularly with regards to no net loss and biodiversity offset policies. Joe has been developing a global database of the biodiversity offsetting projects, and this morning he showed us that majority of some 7,000 projects that they have found are globally very small, and their success is fairly poorly documented, and they are based on regulation rather than voluntary measures mostly. Then we have Marianne Darby. Marianne is a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Conservation Biology at Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research. She works in a science policy interface on biodiversity and ecosystem services. And on her own words, she is really an offset nerd. She did her PhD on voluntary biodiversity offsets, and she has been working on BBOB platform. She is also running a blog on biodiversity offsets. Finally, we have Atte Moilanen. Atte is a research director in Finnish Natural History Museum and Department of Geography in University of Helsinki. Many of us, I believe, heard this morning Atte exploring the important operative decisions that need to be considered when planning biodiversity offsets. It seems also, when I tried to get lunch, that he pickpocketed me in the morning. So I gave him 50 euros, and he took them so many times that I don't know what happened, but I have only Colombian pesos anymore in my wallet. So this was not very good trade. So his research has focused on ecologically based land use planning with methods developed for conservation area network design, environmental impact avoidance, targeting of habitat restoration and biodiversity offsetting, among others. Atte has been invited to be a member of the Finnish Academy of Science and Letters, and this morning he also received the Society for Conservation Biology Distinguished Service Award in memory of Ilkka Hanski. Okay, and we will begin the discussion by hearing what Sirpa Pietikäinen has to say.
I feel so sorry that I can't attend your stakeholder days today in the Jyväskylä, because the topic is very timely and acute and interesting. But unfortunately, it coincides the plenary session in the Strasbourg where I have to be present. But I hope that you send your results, suggestions and new ideas to me so that I could benefit them in the work on the European Parliament when it comes to biodiversity, resource efficiency and other legislative initiatives. So as you know very well, we human beings represent only 0.01% of the total life in the planet. But yet we have managed to destroy 83% of the mammals and roughly 40% of the flora on the planet. And actually, as you know, this development so far is exponential because there's more people, more available income, more goods, and the shorter time spans of the goods. And a lot of the effects of construction is destroying the rest of the biodiversity in accelerating rate, even though we have tried and committed to other kind of the actions. So we need to think very seriously what needs to happen in our regulatory framework and in our thinking to preserve the rest of the biodiversity and hopefully to recuperate some part of it in the future. Firstly, we need to increase substantially the areas that are protected by Habitat Directive or Bird Directive or Natura Area or other strictly strict legislation leaving these areas untouchable, even though Natura, of course, is not that totally. Secondly, we need what Ilkka Hanski has created and calls mosaic protection. That means that one third of the very near nature in my yard, in my housing surroundings, in my city, in my region, in my country, in EU, and globally should be protected. And this sort of a continuing from the smallest protected areas to that are restored and left on the natural state to the biggest scale actually provides that network and possibility of ecosystem services to functions and the natural local biodiversity to flourish. Then we would need a new kind of a physical planning that would mean that, for example, when roads are taking more and more places and cutting half of the living environments and ecosystems, we would need to create corridors and upper levels of area covering the roads so that both the flora and fauna can find its ways. And we need to develop a large scale concept of ecological corridors, meaning that the usual normal fluctuation of species is possible. But besides that, we need new kind of an actions, and this is the ecological compensation. And I'm not in favor for financial monetary ecological compensation, because that easily can create a situation where you can do very devastating, drastic actions and just to compensate it with a minor amount of the money. And that itself doesn't ensure that the actions for preserving the nature would be any better. This is the bad example of the ETS and compensating, for example, the flying mileage, even though it's better than nothing. Actually, it doesn't create better flight techniques or better routings or better fuels for flying. And that should be actually the actions to be taken. So the ecological compensation would be effective if that would be part of the common agricultural policy as prerequisite of getting any subsidies, this mosaic model. If it would be in all physical planning, you have to compensate what you take out of the natural state. And when I'm talking about natural state, I'm not talking about untouchable nature. I'm talking about the parks and trees and the green areas in the cities, for example. And that kind of a compensation idea exists already in Germany, for example. So if you construct a new building, you would need to compensate the amount of land taken and the green potential of that area by green roofs, green walls, green in the yards, greening the bus stops and sides of the roads and whatever is the possibility. And then, and I know this sounds ambitious, it would need to be in the regulation of licensing and permitting different industrial activities. Let's take up the Talvivaara mining example in Finland. The price would be totally different if there would be prerequisite to purchase that amount of land and preserve that to future generations untouched, that is the area covered by the impact of the mining site. And the another important factor there would be that that would set the right price for raw materials that are used the first time. And nowadays, as you know, quite often the problem is that the second-hand raw materials are always more expensive, basically, than the first-hand raw materials. And that, of course, distorts the principle of a circular economy. And by that compensation model, actually, you would benefit the circular economy in one hand, and then on the other hand, you would preserve right amount of the land. And then in the longer run, we would need seriously start discussing globally what is the amount of land and waters we would need to leave without human touch and without any construction in the future. And that then again would facilitate better planning of construction sites, production, reuse, and indeed our urban environments. With all these ideas, it's very hard to have a political decisions if you do not have concrete proposals, concrete models, and some concrete examples like we have in Germany, how this would function in reality. So this is something I leave you with, and I'm expecting to have some wonderful ideas as a return. I hope you very fruitful and innovative days.
Okay, here we had some views from the European Parliament. And maybe we can start by everybody reflecting a little bit what Sirpa had to say. Anybody wants to volunteer for the start? Sure. One point at a time.
Okay. Yeah, so maybe for me that was a direct invitation, as she was mentioning also the German examples, as I'm based in Germany, so I know the German system fairly well, and I also, from a German perspective, I'm usually quite critical. I mean, this is a mature system, but also we are facing problems with the implementations. But I think what I found quite interesting that Sirpa raised, I would say almost 100% of all the crucial points in offset implementation, and I would like to pick up two that I consider also very important, also from the German perspective. The one is the point that she mentioned, that ecological compensation would be considered effective or a success if for any development, for any function or part of nature that would be taken or that would be impacted, that there would be some sort of offset implemented. And that means not necessarily or explicitly not in protected areas, but specifically in what we usually call the ordinary landscape. So the very, as she said, I think she said like the gardens and trees and so on, a bit colloquially speaking. And I think there lies a huge potential. And under the German system, this is exactly what is happening. And I think it's quite important, because all these even small-scale impacts, they sum up to a huge amount in all people's backyards and so on. And so I think this is quite an important point to stress, to really also go for this ordinary landscape. And the second point that I would like to stress, and then maybe someone else can also go on, is that she mentioned also the idea of mosaic protections and ensuring continuity and connectivity from the smallest areas to the bigger scale, and thus also ensuring landscape connectivity. Also, especially when you're dealing with infrastructure development and the issue of fragmentation. And one important point here to raise is also that offsets are something that are not only meant to work on a case-by-case approach, but also ideally they should fit into more strategic goals. So they should be aligned with what usually is called something like landscape-level planning, and to really try to get the best out for nature there, to have strong ecological networks where these offsets can also, though compensating for harm that occurs at some point, also can play a vital role, for example, as stepping stones and in getting a network also of our ecological corridors. Thanks.
Okay, so maybe I'll go on. I have a slightly different perspective to Sirpa's talk. It's fine if our focus is solely on offsets, but what I see is that the need for offsets is kind of a symptom of a symptom or something like that. So the real reason why we are needing, or we have like a, land loss and climate change is that we are having more people all the time, and the people we have are consuming more. And let's assume that we can't go for the reduction in the number of people, so it would mean that we do honestly need like a new model in consumption, in basically making things that are more durable and that we need in less numbers, and maybe people working less, because none of this stuff is going to be happening if we want to be increasing the, let's say, we have a sustainable economic growth continuing. Economic growth is highly correlated with resource use, and if it continues on and on, I mean, nothing's gonna improve. So that's a fundamental discussion that we're going to be bumping into at the societal level later on. And of course, things that one might consider earlier are these taxes that I did mention earlier on, higher taxes on consumption of materials and energy and so on. Slightly closer to the level of offsets, there's one topic that I think is very, very important and which can be done, and that is ecological impact avoidance in, for example, the planning of land use, zoning decisions. And it is possible to figure out at the landscape level where the really important and unique bits are, the ones that are important for ecosystem services as well. And if you do wish to do so, you can avoid those bits when you are doing development projects. Put the development projects in places that are not that useful ecologically. Now, that said, of course, then you bump into massive problems immediately, because that then doesn't anymore treat landowners equally, because some landowners will be sitting on ecological valuable pieces of land, and they may have then problems in actually using their land, whereas the land of others will be good for utilization. And so I see that these bigger issues come before offsets, but I'll of course be happy to talk about the details of offsets slightly later. I'll pass on the mic now.
I don't know if this works. It works. Great. So very wise words from Sirpa. It's very easy to agree on them. And she was, you know, asking for us some concrete examples. And I would say the concrete measures we need, it's not rocket science. We need more protected areas, and we need to manage them better. We need more connectivity, and we need to restore degraded lands. And all these actions we are already doing, and we have already tools to implement them. We just need more effectiveness in doing so. So that's the first step, I would say. And then secondly, as Atte mentioned, the ultimate driver of biodiversity loss is our consumption-based society and lifestyles, and we need to change that. And for that, I see education, research, and awareness raising as very important steps, and it needs to start from very early stages. And then finally, at the third phase, there comes the changes in our regulatory frameworks, and we need new tools, and here offsetting can be one option, and then new financial tools, as we have been talking about taxation, very good example, or even just removing the harmful subsidies. Those are the things that I would say. And then going back to effective implementation, one good example, also Sirpa referred to it, and Atte as well, land use planning. There we have a lot of potential how we could protect our green infrastructure, but it really needs more effective implementation at this point.
Well, I like the message of Sirpa Pietikäinen a lot, and I'm delighted to hear that in the Ministry of Environment there is thinking going on this issue. In the Parliament, we have not yet seen any government proposals anyway. But I think the same way as Minister Tiilikainen, I heard having said to you that without regulation, it's not it's not quite probable that this method of ecological compensation will get more widespread. But in the message of Sirpa, I would like to emphasize the point of incentive. She didn't use that word, but she mentioned the mine Talvivaara, and she mentioned that the whole economics of the mine and economics of any mine would change completely if they had to compensate the biodiversity loss when the mine is established. Roughly 25 years ago, at the time when Sirpa was Minister for Environment and I was in my first term in the Finnish Parliament, I was very irritated, and I'm still irritated, by the way of destroying a lot of land when new roads are built. And I was thinking that we should need a rule that every square meter you take for a new road, the same amount of square meters you should destroy roads somewhere else to turn them back to green spaces. And I thought that I hadn't heard about ecological compensation, but I thought that this would be an incentive for land use planning and road planning to use land in a different way. I read from Janne Kotiaho's report that in the hierarchy, and I agree on this, the first issue should be avoiding biodiversity loss. It's the same as in the European Union waste hierarchy. Avoiding waste is also the top of the hierarchy. And I think that incentives that make it more costly to destroy biodiversity could change the thinking in land use planning and in many kinds of activities. And as Sirpa said, this could be also one way to promote shift to circular economy, which we need if we want to live on this planet, and if we want to make it possible for human societies to continue on this planet. But on this political atmosphere, I would say that the biggest problem is that most people seem to think still that everything on this planet, including all biodiversity, is for people, and that we have the right to do whatever we want. We don't understand well enough that we are living on a spaceship which is very, very far away from everything else in the universe. And if we destroy this planet, there is nobody who comes to help and save us. So we cannot do whatever. We must take care of climate, biodiversity, oceans, etc., if we want to make it possible for human societies to continue on this planet.
Thank you. I agree with many things that Sirpa said. Perhaps most strongly I agree that I would not like to see a financial system that you can sort of write a check that if you cause biodiversity loss, you could just write a check and get rid of the effects. It should be more concrete biodiversity offsets. And perhaps one concrete instrument perhaps would be that we have, of course, for bigger companies, we are using environmental permits. Biodiversity offset settings could be one part of the permit that you, if you create biodiversity loss, you need to have some biodiversity offsettings to get the permit, environmental permit. Then Sirpa raised the question that should these compensations be part of CAP, Common Agricultural Policy, which is of course a very interesting proposal, but knowing how complex system it is, I'm not sure is that a too big of a part to bite to take at one. I would feel that we need to start with take small steps and need to try these things in smaller parts.
Yeah, so I'm going last, and I get the pleasure of agreeing with everyone so far, more or less. I think it was an excellent talk that we had, and also agree with most of the comments from the panel. I was actually listening to this morning whilst I was drinking my coffee in the background, and I think I almost dropped my cup when I heard her mention the Common Agricultural Policy. I thought, wow, that's ambitious. But anyway, so some of the main points just to reflect on with that. I think before we get to compensation, I think a really important point was talking about increasing protected area coverage, but really the focus should be on improving management of existing protected areas. I think you made that point. And I think there's been a lot of research recently saying that really needs to be the focus. You know, improving management of existing PAs as much as expanding protected areas. I really agree with the idea about planning for ecosystem integrity alongside human infrastructure development. I think Marianne mentioned that. So I was glad to see that being talked about there as well. But coming on to compensation, as I say, I agree with most of the points that the rest of the panel have made. Yes, I think it's interesting to talk about making it part of regulation. I think that's probably quite an important point to consider. And I think it's incredibly important, and Ate and some of our other colleagues mentioned the point about not discussing this without discussing avoidance first. That was a point I labored very strongly in my own talk this morning, and I'm really glad that that keeps coming up, because we can't talk about compensation without first talking about avoidance of impacts. Just one final thing to add on to the end, which hasn't been mentioned yet. I'm always a little bit cautious when people talk about compensation programs that apply to everything. I'm not saying that shouldn't be done necessarily, but I think we need to be very careful about thinking about ecological compensation as kind of an all-singing, all-dancing, world-saving, this is a solution to all our problems type mechanism. I think it needs to be I think it needs to be very specifically targeted. And I think we need to be careful about framing it as something we can use to save the world. I think it has specific purposes, and we should make sure it's designed to see out those specific purposes.
Okay, thank you. Atte, okay.
Can I say something to continue from Joe's? So it's for sure offsets are not going to be saving the world. And the reason for that is that offsets are targeting no net loss. So if you lose something and you restore, you have no net loss. And then you have the avoided loss offset so that something is declining and you develop a gain against that. But none of this is stopping any of the cumulative impacts that are happening all around due to pollution and whatever, long distance effects, climate change. None of the offsets are stopping any of that. So while there might be like no net loss at a local scale in limited projects, it's not stopping the environmental degradation that's going on. So that should be very clear.
Yeah, just to add on this and to be even more blunt on this, I mean, biodiversity offsetting, to be quite clear, they're happening when things have already gone wrong. You know, so that's by definition, it's nothing to save the world with. So therefore, I'm also very glad to the points raised by Atte and by several here, that eventually we really, I would go even one step further than what you said, Joe. It's not starting with avoidance, but rather before even starting to think about this whole mitigation hierarchy and independent of offsets, questioning development decisions that are made. And this refers back to what you've said about our consumption patterns and in a very first place, always to think about whether we need such and such development. Often there is, I can't hear this anymore, this phrase of overriding public interest, which is somehow sort of a very blurry buzzword. And I think this is something that I, maybe it's easy to say this from a science perspective, but I also want to give back to policy, and I see a clear responsibility also on the side of policy here to rethink how decision-making is processes are ongoing, and how this shall be more questions in terms of development priorities, also for different prioritization of nature in development decisions.
Yeah, okay, go on.
Well, I'm a layman in this issue, but when I was reading the report on compensating biodiversity loss, the biggest question mark for me was that, well, anyway, we have limited space on this planet. We cannot increase the area, the surface of this planet. And so I think that maybe this is a different issue, but maybe anyway related. I think we should need new kinds of new methods for constructing things. For example, I like very much in a fairly new regulation. I don't know if it's just in Paris or in whole France, but anyway, some years ago I read that in Paris they have decided that for every new building you are building, the roof must be either green or covered with solar panels. So we do have a lot of area that is now constructed by people, which is from the point of view of living nature, we are like smaller or bigger pieces of desert. So I think one of the issues we really need to do is to create methods of greening these deserts, for example, roofs.
Juha, you had something? No. Okay, so I think that the message that I got from this discussion so far is that we should not develop, we should not consume, and we should not reproduce. So the thing is that I don't think that this is very realistic at this moment that we would stop developing and consuming or even reproducing. So the fact is that there are limits to growth, and these are the things that ultimately really, I mean, seriously, we have to tackle. So basically, this, I think that this puts the topic of this discussion, which is the ecological compensations, in the perspective that they are like a tiny mosquito making a small noise, because these other things are the big issues that we have to resolve. But maybe these ecological compensations, even though if it's a mosquito, it might still be worthwhile. And Atte has something to say.
Yeah, I think we may be missing here something about the lack of space. I mean, can't we just live underground in artificial caves?
Well, isn't that what is going to happen if we build the green roofs everywhere? So we are basically not moving underground, but we are moving the ground on top of us.
I don't think that's enough, but that might be a tiny part of a bigger solution. Anyway, I think this is an important concept. Anyway, many issues which are really big and common nowadays have started from a very, very small start. Like, for example, electricity. We hardly can imagine life without electricity now. But still, 200 years ago, it was a hobby of rich gentlemen who had some extra time for doing all kinds of mysterious tests. So 200 years ago, nobody could have imagined a society that is fully dependent on having electricity everywhere. I say that as an electrical engineer.
Yeah, I kind of want to challenge the notion that there has to be like a continuous growth in consumption. Because you kind of think that technology is advancing really quickly. If we want to, we can make things so that they use less. So a few years ago, legislation was passed so that the taxes paid on cars started depending on how much gasoline they use. And all of a sudden, people start buying cars that are using less gasoline. It wasn't that hard, and I don't think people really have suffered too much due to that. So why is it when we talk about energy, it's all of the time talking about how do we build sufficient renewable energy so that the energy consumption can continue growing,
the way it does. And it just seems like that there's an utter and complete lack of effort in investing even a little bit in actually trying to get the same services or even more, but with just, you know, less energy. It is technologically possible, I'm certain.
That is true, but this issue is not absent from politics. There are just now going on negotiations on European Union energy efficiency targets. It was last week we discussed the Finnish government position on this issue in the Environment Committee of the Finnish Parliament. So it's really very true that many decisions that have anyway improved the material and energy efficiency of the society, normal people hardly have noticed them. For example, when the taxation was changed so that leaded gasoline in the gas stations became more expensive than unleaded gasoline, it was almost overnight when people switched to unleaded gasoline. And nowadays, I think young people would be shocked to know that 25 years ago, cars were like emitting lead all around. One example of political decisions that has made a big noise, but which people don't complain about anymore, was when European Union decided to ban selling of incandescent lamps. That this decision was very unpopular, and in this country I was the culprit for this bad EU bureaucracy decision. But this decision created market for LEDs. And in roughly 2 years, LEDs had developed to really useful lamps, and now you hardly hear any complaining of this EU decision anymore. And this decision has anyway made it possible to everybody on this planet to have LEDs instead of energy wasting incandescent lamps. So these are just small examples of political decisions that have made a difference, but of course we do need much, much more.
Okay, it seems like we are opening a big can of worms after another before we actually go into the small mosquito, but Juha, you can have the last say on this issue.
Okay, I of course agree that we need a sort of a systematic change in our way of consuming things, but some of us still remember 70s. And I think during the 70s we did this. We had all these save energy, save oil campaigns because we had oil crisis. So it's possible, and these things have been done. Of course, our political system is perhaps a little bit difficult because it goes in 4-year periods. So it really needs a sort of a long-sighted and bold politicians who would be sort of bold enough to make the decisions, because we can really change the world by doing drastic political decisions.
Okay, so let's move on a little bit. So I personally have been in small-scale political decision-making for 8 years in the past at the regional level, and what I learned during that time, the best way of delaying decisions is saying that, oh, we don't know enough. So basically, I wanted to ask, I actually took this question from Marianne earlier this day when she was asking from Joe that have we actually resolved the technical and conceptual problems that we have with ecological compensation or biodiversity offsetting? So is science ready? Can we actually tell, we scientists, can we tell already what should we be doing if we are implementing it with enough credibility or enough certainty that they will or will not work?
Thank you for bringing that question back to me again. I was saved by the music the first time, but not this time. So I think it's an important question, and I think I'd like to rephrase slightly some of the things I said earlier on. I was talking earlier on about needing more empirical understanding of the way offsets work. I'm going to just use biodiversity offsets and ecological compensation interchangeably. I think what I really should have said is that we don't have enough information to make complete generalizations about offsets, whether they do work or don't. What we do have is a lot of information and a lot of studies that have shown specific do's and don'ts about offsets. I think that's the important thing. So I think we can move forward with what we know, bearing in mind that there are still some uncertainties remaining, but we have more than enough information to go ahead and say, well, there are certain things we definitely shouldn't do if we try and implement some kind of policy involving biodiversity offsets. So, for example, certain habitats shouldn't be involved in those programs. And if I can give a small example, in the UK, there was a kind of a draft or pilot biodiversity offset policy, which was almost immediately dead in the water because people talked about offsetting ancient woodlands, which is, you know, ludicrous, clearly. But so there's certain things we shouldn't do. There's certain things we should do. And so, for instance, Ate and Yana, you've given a lot of interesting information in the report that you've just brought out about kind of certain ways of designing biodiversity offsets and the considerations, the things we need to think about when we do that. So we know what some of the key challenges are, and we have some ways of overcoming those challenges. So I think the main thing to say is, yes, we do have enough information to go forward with designing our biodiversity offset policies. We can't make generalizations about them, but we can say in certain habitats, given certain institutions, given certain social situations, and for certain sectors, yes, we have enough information to kind of try these things out. And then the onus on us is then to, once we've implemented them, to kind of make sure there's a really robust kind of monitoring and assessment process in place to make sure they actually work and that's being monitored. So that would be my response.
Atte and Marianne, Atte.
Yeah, I would kind of think that we know enough, you know, if we want to. But I was going to be asking the people who are more in the administration that given that offsets will, if they're really done honestly, they will cost quite a bit of money, they will be somewhat complicated to implement and monitor and maintain. There will be issues about land ownership and things. Can it be seen that offsets could ever be a compulsory part of the Finnish legislation, or is the best we could ever hope for is that they can be done voluntarily by businesses who want to do so? Is it at all realistic that it could be compulsory to be offsetting a lot of large and medium-sized and even maybe small development projects?
I would like to hear the Minister of Education. Ministry of Environment. How is the thinking in the Ministry of Environment? Maybe it should be the minister to answer, but maybe you can also illustrate a bit of the thinking.
I try to be careful with my answer. Anyhow, I wouldn't say it's completely impossible to see legislation. And actually, we're seeing reports, like legislative papers, where we have direct recommendations how we could introduce these compensations into our regulatory frameworks. And we have actually one project now going on, which will lead into concrete political and legislative proposals, how to proceed. So we could, but then again, it's because of this complexity. It's very, very difficult. Every lawyer in this room knows how difficult it is to design such a legislation that is, on one hand, flexible enough to make this possible, but then also enforceable and effective. And of course, from the environmental administrator point of view, it's very, of course, important that compensations really bring added value, because we have also other options.
So that's one of the things I was thinking. I didn't quite articulate it, but given how complicated offsets can be, then if you want to be writing like binding legislation around the offsets, then how do you describe the development and implementation and enforcement of offsets so that it's not like an endless mire for lawyers and anybody who wants to be So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why early on I was just saying, you know, just put on the increased taxes and use that money for, you know, improving the environment. Anyway.
So we kind of jumped already forward, but Marianne, did you have something on the whether we know enough or not?
Yes, I mean, I raised the question, but still I have also a few thoughts on that, and maybe 3 points. The first is I would like to maybe quote Atte from this morning when you said your response was basically if offsets are a promising tool, yes, no, and maybe. So, and my response to this question is kind of the same. The reason for this is that, similar to what Joe has said, there has been a lot of scientific work already done, both at the conceptual level on, for example, counterfactuals, additionality, etc. You have a number of papers and studies out there, but also on specific countries and the practical experiences that have also been studied and accompanied by science, for example, in the US, but also in Germany and under other contexts. So there is a lot out there, but still, an important point to stress here is that context is really important. So it is still very tricky to generalize from these findings. And I think science also here has to have an accompanying role. So we do know a lot, and we have a lot of knowledge available. But still, this process, which is good for a scientist, this process is never ending. So there will always be a need to accompany these practical implementation processes. And I really liked, in our session this morning, we had the Swedish practitioner's perspective from Arthur Granberg and Torbjörn Josefsson, and they said they stated quite clearly that it is important to, early in the process and throughout the whole process, make the link between researchers and the people who are actually implementing offsets, so the developers, but also the consultants and such. So there's a strong need for science also ongoing. And then maybe to conclude, maybe a little bit of a critical twist in this, maybe the question if we have enough knowledge or science has done its job and answers the question maybe is not quite the right question. I was pursuing this question maybe for quite some years, and then I realized when I spoke especially to local authorities who in the German context are really the ones that drive the offset implementation, that it's fine if you have a really nice, you know, like valuation technique, methods, and everything nicely planned in place. But in the end, it's really about the people who implement it. And in the case of a regulatory scheme, this means really the people and the authorities, that they have enough capacity and enough knowledge about it. And I have heard this, you know, like basically for someone who's really into offset, that's quite heartbreaking when you hear then, you know, we're doing offsets, but actually there's hardly any monitoring and follow-up happening, so we never actually know if all our shiny, nice plans are put into practice. So therefore, I would say, yes, it's nice. We have a lot of knowledge, and it's good to have that there, but it's even more important on the implementation and policy side to have enough capacity there, and especially also for monitoring and follow-up.
Juha, and then Satu.
Perhaps coming back to Atte's question about the legislation, I think we can think perhaps this as a continuum. There are the voluntary things that we can do, and then some legally binding. But could there be something in between, that the legislation could be giving the framework and perhaps facilitating that companies who would use ecological compensation perhaps could get a competitive advantage for using ecological compensation. So then it would be sort of giving incentives for companies to use this instrument as well.
Or could we have a combination? Well, my feeling is that we know enough to start. And actually, I would love to hear more detailed ideas about where exactly to start. So I'm not so optimistic that I would think that it would be possible to to make a law that says that like every piece of land where you destroy the biodiversity, you must compensate it somehow somewhere else. But maybe we could find activities where we had this mandatory. I don't know if road construction could be one such activity, but anyway, so if we find one or a couple of activities where this would be mandatory, then we would learn from this practical activity. And then we could also have legislation setting criteria, as for example, we have EU legislation on what you have to do in order to sell your product as organic. In the same way, it's voluntary for the farmers to decide if they want to farm organic, but in order to sell their products as organic, they have to meet certain criteria. And maybe the approach for most sectors could be the same.
Yeah, I'd like to just carry on this discussion about whether it should be mandatory or not. I agree it probably is incredibly difficult to do that, as to speak to the points from over there. But I think it's really important, because I think if there's no mandatory requirement whatsoever, then I think there's going to be very few actual examples of this being put into practice. I think if you look at the data for offsets around the world, I think the vast majority are implemented as a result of some kind of mandatory requirement, whether that's legislation or policy, or whether it's through project finance or whatever it is. So I think, but it can be on a spectrum. It doesn't have to be mandatory for everything. But I think there needs to be some element of something being mandatory in there. And I just want to, I think the idea of starting on a certain subset, like an activity or a certain habitat or whatever, I think makes a lot of sense. Like I said, I don't think we should go in and say, apply this to all habitats and all activities and everything in the entire economy. I think it makes a lot of sense to start on specific targets.
Atte, you had something?
Yeah, I was going to comment on Marianne's comment about a lack of monitoring and resources in the administration, and I think there must be some kind of a misunderstanding about the responsibilities of developers and the administration, because if somebody needs offsets, I think automatically the developer should also pay for a certain amount of monitoring and also pay for the administrative expenses of, you know, getting the thing designed and the paperwork done and whatever. It's a part of it, and they should be paying for it.
100%.
Yeah, I definitely completely agree, but still, in financial terms, I completely agree that you should rely on the developer there and make him or her responsible, but still you need some oversight, and usually that's then done by government authorities or NGOs, etc., and this is still something that needs to be put in place, and that's something, if you want to have this at a large scale, and ideally have this for all development impacts, then this is also something that's quite challenging to set up. And I completely agree that if you want to set something like this up, basically from scratch, that it's a good pathway to start with some very specific targeted, for example, ecosystems or impacts or whatsoever.
Can I build on that point slightly, giving a concrete example? So I worked on a pipeline project, and it wasn't actually specifically a known at loss project, but at the end of the day, they were doing ecological compensation, and their idea was to go far beyond the actual impacts. So it's kind of a net positive type of impact project, even though it wasn't specifically, when it was designed, about quantifying losses and gains. But what they did was, they, building on Atta's point about the responsibility being on the developer to kind of fund all this, this pipeline project, they built a whole set of different restoration projects to make up for the impacts they had. It was in a national park. And they also kind of designed a monitoring program as part of that. And I came into the project a decade after it was implemented and was asked to kind of review progress so far on the restoration projects. They'd done an incredible job to that point. And they had plans and funds in place to monitor as an ongoing basis what was going on there. In fact, the one of the big issues they'd had was how to spend all the money they had for restoration projects. The team who were implementing it were struggling to find enough ways to spend the money to actually get rid of it all into restoration projects. Which is a nice problem to have, I guess. But the point I want to make is that was all designing all that kind of stuff into the project, and it was a fraction of the project cost. I mean, we're talking the order of magnitude of 1% or less of the cost of the overall project to actually design the offset, put the money towards restoration projects, and design a monitoring program that was then going on for decades. So I think it's very feasible to do that, and I think it's really important. It's seen as part of the responsibility.
It seems to me like there is, across the board, there seems to be a kind of agreement that in small steps, mandatory or some regulation is needed, but not across the board immediately, but in small steps. And Satu was asking that we need some concrete examples, that where can we go and test it? And you mentioned road building. So, yeah, road building, when you are building a large road, it's actually a government-funded project. So wouldn't that be very easy to start? So what is your view? Should we start from government's own projects, or should we actually go to the other sectors? How should we start going? Say yes.
Well, I can. Well, I can guess that the Ministry of Transport would not love this idea. They have been very effective in this country to launch a concept of korjausvelka, like depth of maintenance depth of the roads, and of course if in constructing of new roads they had to finance taking care of biodiversity somewhere else, they would not love the idea. But I don't know if this is too simplistic. But anyway, I learned that I have known since a long time that the biggest number of endangered species in this country, they are forest species, but also wetlands belong to critical ecosystems, and so maybe it could be possible, maybe this is too simple, but maybe it could be possible that when you construct roads, then it would be mandatory to protect certain area of a wetland which is now unprotected, or some other like endangered ecosystem. But but anyway, as I said, I know that the Ministry of Transport would hate this idea. But anyway, as a society, we have to understand that we have to protect biodiversity. So taking care of the biodiversity is part of the true cost of all activities. So another way to think about the cost is to think that then we have the real cost visible of the activities.
Yeah, I think that's a big issue, because in a way, at the moment, if there is a big accident, like Talvivaara was mentioned, it's the government who pays in the end when the companies are going bankrupt. So in a way, it is in the end, it is anyway the government. So why not start from the government?
Can I add to...
Oops. Yeah, I promised Marianne.
Okay, yeah, exactly on that point. And I guess you're raising an important point how one could set this up. Because imagine that usually some regulation is not popping up like this, and if it would for developers, that would be quite hard to handle because there's a high degree of uncertainties and risk, and they wouldn't really know what to do about it. So therefore, I think it's quite an appealing and logic approach to say, let's start with some pilots and some government initiatives
I see two examples here. The one thing is the one you mentioned from the infrastructure development, like large-scale projects where you could set up some larger pilots. But the other idea would be rather to focus on local or municipal level, for example, for infrastructure and housing development there, because there you could you make use of this point stressed earlier to build on the land use planning and also on the landscape planning available, and you would have the people. Of course, you would need to feed them some extra capacity there in the very beginning, but you would have the people there knowledgeable about the structure of the local community, about the land use planning, about the priorities, both in terms of infrastructure development, but also in terms of nature conservation priorities. So, and therefore, and that's also something that's happened in Germany, that at this very local level, where things started to work, and then this, when things are implemented, this can give a good example also then for other sorts of development projects. And one thing that I would also like to stress, because the point of maybe not having this strict either mandatory or voluntary system, especially at local level, this provides an opportunity also for some sort of voluntary add-ons and creation of compensation pools and habitat banks. And in Germany, what happened basically in the 1990s, that they tried this out, that the local administration, they set aside some land to use this for compensation for their own needs. So, but this was first on a very voluntary basis, and then also developers made use of it. And in this combination, it's sometimes a bit hard to understand and a bit blurry, but in this, let's say, more explorative phase, there's also a great chance in trying to encourage, you know, like learning along the process and trying to get people involved in this, because I fear that really if you go there and set up a regulation and say, here it is, this is what you have to do, and even though you might provide really good guidance, then people still might feel a bit overwhelmed with what to do. And then the other point is if what often happens with offsets, if you don't think about fines and sanction, and that this is a major problem also in Germany, then, you know, if people just don't implement them, then you have not really, you know, you have a huge enforcement deficit. And so it's better to try to get people on the way and give a good example. So I definitely second Jan's point to start with some government initiatives and preferably at the local level.
Subi, you want to say something?
I just have another suggestion. This is actually something that Leila Suvantola suggested already in 2006. We could put mandatory compensation every time when we need to derogate from the strict protection of species, of habitats, birds directive species, because nowadays you get the permit even though it might have a small effect on favorable conservation status, or it should not. But the problem is that for one case, it probably doesn't, but then when we have 10 or 100 of cases, when they accumulate, then we actually might lose the favorable conservation status. So one option would be to start from there. So each time when we need to derogate from this protection, we would need to compensate. And it would apply, of course, all activities. It wouldn't be sector specific.
Okay, Joe, Satu, and Juha.
Thank you. Yeah, a number of points to pick up on. I think in terms of, and I'll come to that in a sec, but just going back to the discussion about sectors, I think, yes, in some ways it makes sense to look at, say, the transport sector, the infrastructure sector, as a way to start applying these kind of ideas. But I think what Marianne said was really important, which is that, you know, there's also a lot of arguments starting at a kind of smaller level than that. I think a lot of the experience in offsetting around the world has been, you know, a lot of the experience that can be built upon has been in urban development, you know, small-scale development. So whether that's in Germany, but also in Australia and in America and in Canada, you know, a lot of the experience is in small-scale stuff. And the giving examples is so important, right? Giving examples of successful projects. And I guess that's one of the problems if you start with big infrastructure projects is how many years do you have to wait till you actually get an offset? You know, 10 years, 15 years for a project to get approval, go through the planning process, get an offset agreed, and then finally, you know. So I think it's really important to think about some small-scale stuff as well so that you actually have examples to build upon. I think coming on to the point about targeting, you know, protected species, I think that makes sense in some ways, but at the same time, I think it's quite a difficult way to launch kind of an ecological compensation policy, because I think a lot of the complaints about it are always about license to trash and that kind of stuff, and preventing impacts that should be prevented in the first place. So I feel like it's important to bear that in mind when designing a new offset a compensation policy.
Of course, there should also, the mitigation hierarchy should be central.
But that absolutely, and I know you're saying that, but I mean just in terms of the perception of a new policy, I think if it's, and I'm not a policy expert, but my experience in the UK, certainly, a lot of the resistance to that was because it was launched on protected species and protected habitat. Whereas if you start by saying, this is not giving developers a license to destroy stuff they wouldn't have been able to destroy anyway. So instead target less protected habitats, kind of, you know, less conservation priority habitats as a starting point. I feel like that's going to encounter less public resistance, would be my thought on that.
Yep. I would like to continue on this local development issue. So that's sort of in between level, between law and just like private voluntary activity. So I don't believe that construction companies would be very willing to start ecological compensation, but there could be municipalities that are willing to make it mandatory, at least in some parts of the municipality. There are also municipalities in Finland, and I think in most industrialized countries, that have said local climate targets that are more ambitious than the national climate target. For example, city of Helsinki, my own city, Tampere, and all the biggest cities of Finland, I think, have set municipal climate targets that are more ambitious than the national target. And the approach could be the same in this issue.
Yeah, I would like to come back to sort of the issue that should state projects be showing the example. Of course, it's in a way a political issue, so as a civil servant you need to be quite careful what you are going to say. But for my opinion, states should of course show rather good example than bad example. But I think in Metsähallitus we have had some pilot projects in offsets already. But I have to admit, I don't remember how. They were not very easy projects, but there have been some projects going on. And of course, I'm not sure are the roads the best example to start from, but I also like the idea that the municipalities or the local level could do more in this issue.
Yeah, Atte. Yeah, I'm just going to put in a disagreeable word about this starting from pilot projects. I reckon the first thing you should do is figure it out how it should be done, and then you can do a good pilot project. But just doing a pilot project, whatever, and then it becomes the example, that can be really bad if it goes wrong. So if you want pilot projects, at least do good ones. So.
Fair point.
So, Satu, you mentioned that the building companies might not be eager to go for ecological compensations. But then there is this permitting procedure and they have to pay for the building permits and they are not small. So wouldn't it be an easy way of kind of regulating this part of it and just including the environmental compensations in the building permit that you don't actually have to ask whether they want it or not, but it's just mandated there.
Yeah, that's actually what I meant with the idea that municipalities could be the ones to set this as a prerequisite for getting the construction permit. But of course, at least in theory, we could have that as a legal obligation. But I think from the point of view of political decision making, it might be more realistic to get it started, at least in the beginning in some municipalities, than to start as a law, at least if we think about a law that is about all construction projects. But anyway, I hope that this discussion will be reflected in the Ministry of education when I mean environment, in the Ministry of Environment that is responsible for the legislation on land use planning. So I hope that these ideas are studied and developed in the ministry.
Trust me, they are.
That was a promise. So, Atte, you wanted to say something.
I was just wondering, so that the Ministry of Environment is responsible, but so what's the role of the Ministry of Agriculture and Forestry, and also what's the business ministry, Kauppa and Teollisuus ministry, what's that in English? Anyway, so there might be...
I think it's Ministry of Economy nowadays.
Yeah, Ministry of Economy. So what would be the role of these other ministries in, because obviously these sectors of the society would be impacted?
Yeah, well, it's difficult to say what's the concrete role, but very often when we are speaking about doing legislation, we are doing it quite a bit together with Ministry of Environment. So I'm sure we will be part, as the land legislation for land use planning, there is now a big reform going on, in fact, starting right now, and it's going to last for a few years, so we are also involved in that. And when it comes to forestry and forestry legislation, that's also for us to look at.
May I guess that if there will be a serious discussion on EU level about making ecological compensation as something mandatory as a prerequisite for agricultural subsidies, then the role of our Ministry of Agriculture is to strongly oppose. This is just a guess.
Depending on the minister, of course. But I'm sure, as you know, the Association for Landowners most likely is the one who's going to oppose.
So it looks to me that we are now looking who is responsible of starting, and we don't find one. So basically, what can we take the initiative, like a smaller step? Where can we take the smaller step? So where can we start?
Well, I can promise that the Environment Committee of the Parliament will ask this issue from Minister Tiilikainen, that we want to know how this issue is going forward in the Ministry of Environment in land use planning legislation.
Okay, good. That was a concrete promise that something is going to happen. Others?
I promise I will brief Minister Tiilikainen
about this. Yeah, okay. So this is actually something that I was planning that in the very end that we would be asking that what everybody is going to do. And now, Satu, you already said what you are going to do. So, one question about the municipalities. So, it is because the building permitting is the task of the municipalities, right? So, how can we influence them? What should we do in order to get the ball rolling? There is like several of them. So, if one takes it, takes the lead, let's say Helsinki is doing something, taking the lead, showing that, okay, we start doing ecological compensation, how can we spread it across the country if there is no regulation to do it?
Well, I think it would help to have examples, and City of Helsinki might be very, very good candidate to start. And I think that one way to make the ball rolling is to that the scientists that are working on this issue would contact, for example, Mayor Vapaavuori and Vice Mayor Anni Sinnemäki in Helsinki. That's my concrete proposal. And maybe also City of Tampere, the Mayor Lauri Lyly, and, well, I shame to say, but I don't know who is responsible for city planning issues in my own hometown now, but it's easy to find the name.
Yeah, Marianne.
Yeah, I would like to follow up on that point, and I think good examples that are appealing to people are actually the best advertising to spread this. And just speaking from the German perspective, I have, for example, a friend working in a German municipality, and she's responsible for implementing offsets that the municipality is responsible for. And sometimes she was showing around some people to some of her offset projects, and then the people, they weren't involved in all these things, and they were like, wow, this is an offset, this looks so nice. So this was also something which had multiple benefits and was also appealing to the local population. And there's another quite nice example that I quite often cite. It is an archaeological site in Saxony, and this is next to a Natura 2000 area, so it's not a Natura 2000, but the compensation is adjacent to it. So, and there they have created an offset which aligns with overall nature conservation goals, which nicely fits to the Natura 2000 sites, which picks up this archaeological site, and therefore it's also really nice for people to go there, and building on the integration or the involvement of a lot of different local stakeholders helped a lot, that people were also really proud of it. It was in the newspapers, and they went with the kindergarten there. And so this is something that, especially when we're talking about these more local things and municipalities, that when people then take ownership of it and they start to feel proud of it, and then you obviously you have to have some sort of events where you can showcase this, and then they can show it to other municipalities, and they will, you know, that's easy human behavior. They will become jealous and say, oh, I want something cool like that as well. That would work in our municipality as well. And you could maybe show them that there's also a potential in this. And I think that could be a positive way of trying to scale this up. I mean, this is not something that is happening, you know, like with a snap of your fingers, but that's something that with a little bit of time that you can build up.
You have?
Janne was asking for concrete actions. We, in our ministry, we are now at the moment updating the national forest strategy, and I could promise that we take this issue up to discussion also in that process.
That's very good. Thank you. When I'm looking at the audience, I decided in the beginning we were about 80 people in the very beginning, and I was thinking that when we are losing half of the people, then we should consider whether we continue much longer. Now we are in about 40. So but my promise is, and this actually, this whole day, this stakeholder day is one of those things. So we have been discussing about ecological offsetting and biodiversity offsetting all day long, and I see one Jyväskylä City Council member, I think, up there nodding. Yes, she's here. So I think that I will ask this member of the council to actually take this forward in the city of Jyväskylä as well and try to do something about this issue, that city of Jyväskylä could actually be the one showing the way that now we have to be the first in Finland, you know? Jyväskylä first. Okay, so do we have any final remarks from anybody? Do you have something very heavy to say still? Or are we all looking for the Otus beer that is waiting for us in some local pub? So this is, for those who didn't know yet, we have a special Congress beer brewed specifically for this in Hiisipanimo, so, and it's called Otus. Okay, so I think that we got some promises, and now we just have to implement them, and this is always the big challenge. So I thank you all, thank you very much, and thank you for the audience for bearing us until this late hour, and I hope this day has given us something to look forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.